Sounds like you're bringing the music down, guys. Is it time for the main course? Part Q?
Tis.
Okay, well, this is your host, Katie Kiefer. I'm missing my partner in crime, Patrick Martins. He's out in Kansas City picking turkeys. No, he's counting turkeys, actually, is what he's doing. But he'll be back, maybe not next week, but the week after. In the meantime, we miss him for these shows. As I said, main course part Q on the Heritage Radio Network. We are located in the back garden of Roberta's Pizza, 261 Moore Street in Bushwick, Brooklyn. Today's sponsor is Hearst Ranch. 155,000 acres of protected grasslands where they're growing the best beef out there. So thank you to Hearst Ranch. Thanks to my engineer, my producer today, Jack Inslee, my producer, Nat Wiener, my engineer. And our first guest for the queue is Drew Becker. Drew, Becker. Are you there?
Becker, you got it.
Becker. Drew, you are the executive director of the New York Restoration Project, right?
Correct.
And I invited you on today because we've all, here at Roberta's, we've all been really impressed with the work you guys are doing. And I thought maybe you could just give us a quick overview of this organization, and then let's drill down on a couple of specific aspects of your strategic goals. Because, boy, do you guys have a smoking hot website. Woohoo!
Thank you. It's brand new. We just actually launched it.
It's terrific. It is absolutely brilliant. It's like clear. It's divided into all the right places. It's got a very clearly stated strategic goals for your organization and a really clear mission statement and what you're working on now and what you hope to be doing in the next, 5, 10, 15 years. So let's start just with what New York Restoration Project does in general and then get busy with some of the more esoteric aspects.
Will do. Well, we were founded in 1995 by Bette Midler when she actually moved back to New York from Los Angeles, mm-hmm. and really was sort of dismayed the way the city looked, and really started with a bunch of volunteers cleaning up New York City, and sponsored, and it was actually she helped create Clean Up the Canyons in L.A. and we're really modeled off of that model at first. So that's really the how we got started. Then, and we were basically a cleaning green group, cleaning up northern Manhattan parks like Fort Washington, Fort Tryon, Highbridge parks in northern Manhattan for a while. And then in 1999, Mayor Giuliani at the time was going to sell a bunch of the community gardens all throughout the city.
Oh yeah, I remember when that was happening.
Yeah. And we, along with the Trust for Public Land, went in and saved about 120 gardens across the city that were going to be sold to developers.
Uh-huh.
And have really worked over the last basically 10 years to transform those properties into amazing sort of little urban farms, little central parks, village greens all over the city.
Mm-hmm.
And then in 2006, we launched Million Trees NYC, which is our plan to plant 1 million trees in New York City's five boroughs over the next 10 years.
Are you cooperating with the mayor's office on this? I kind of remember that Bloomberg is somehow involved in the Million Trees.
We actually have the idea we brought to the mayor's office and part of his Plan YC 2030 plan. It was included in there, and working with the Parks Department in order to make that a reality. We're actually 20% ahead of schedule.
Fantastic.
We so far planted 285,000 trees in New York City.
What kind of trees are you planting?
We're planting a lot of natives.
Uh-huh.
So there's a list of about 20 to 30 trees that we actually work off of. 60 when we get into like some of the larger parks, and then street trees. It really goes down to like your standbys, which is the Bradford pears, the honey locust, the ginkgo, and that type of thing. Just because they're trees that can survive in those particular elements.
Yeah, i.e. exhaust, heavy exhaust, and probably a fairly shallow root structure.
Yeah, exactly. Street trees, they're just up against, all odds. And, a lot of them, it's amazing. A lot of them adapt and, they're quite beautiful when they make the streets much better.
Isn't the honey locust the tree that has those beautiful sort of pale lime colored blossoms throughout July and August, and then they turn into pods in September?
Yes.
I could not for the life of me figure out what those were. And then finally we had a guy named Bill Logan, who's an urban arborist. And I described them to him, and he was able to tell us what those were. Finally, I was like, oh, yes, at last, I know what these are. Because I think those are one of the most beautiful city trees I've ever seen. I mean, next to the London plane tree and the ginkgo, I think that the honey locust is really one of the most, you know, the trees that give you the most value in terms of aesthetic qualities throughout the year. It's just a really beautiful tree. And it took me the longest time to even notice it. But then when I did, it's all I could see. So, Drew, I wanted to ask you about a couple of specific projects that you mentioned on your website. And most notably is your plan to revitalize the Harlem River, which includes Swindler's Cove and Sherman Creek. And I just loved the sort of historical aspect of both of those names. And I wondered if you could tell us a little bit more about what that project is all about and what, you know, how you guys will be able to get people to, you know, start using that part of the island.
Definitely. Well, the Harlem River is one of those rivers that it's really sort of the stepchild, it seems like, of all the rivers.
Seems like
it. It sort of gets overlooked all the time. But it's actually, when you get up in northern Manhattan, basically from around 165th Street north, it's amazing the way the terrain of the island starts changing. And this river becomes basically a river between, it's in a valley through there, which is quite gorgeous. And the whole concept of the Harlem River Master Plan, which we would like to do, sometime, is really to turn the Harlem River into a recreational opportunity. We created Sherman, the Swindler Cove area, part of Sherman Creek, which is basically a 12-acre park in northern Manhattan that we have a floating boathouse. Every time people hear this, they can't believe it. But actually, rowing in this country was actually born on the Harlem River. It was not in the Schuylkill in Philly or the Charles in Boston. It was actually right up there in the Harlem River. That's where all the colleges had their boathouses, like they have down in Philadelphia.
So where would I go if I wanted to go up to this part of the city?
The 10th Avenue, and for those people, 10th Avenue in really northern Manhattan is actually on the east side of the island because it cuts in up there. So it's 10th Avenue, Dyckman, and the Harlem River Drive where it connects all right there, basically about 200th Street. And you'll see the most amazing, it's Highbridge Park is just an amazing park that is there that is a very historic park and just hiking trails. And then Swindler Cove is an area down toward the river where is actually the only natural shoreline left on the island of Manhattan.
Really?
And it's the most amazing place. And I would recommend that anybody that just sort of wants to feel like they need to get out of the city for a while, go there because you'll feel it. It's amazing.
And you can take the subway.
You can. You get off at Broadway and Dyckman, and it's the one train, or you can take the A train as well.
Fantastic. And Swindler's Cove, is that an old historic name, or is that a name you guys assigned to it?
That was a name that we assigned to it. This park did not exist. It was basically just a dump. It was a dump, in 2001. They built a school, PS5. In the middle of this, in the middle of basically a dump,
Waste dump. How great!
Seriously, it was unbelievably awful, and Bette, you know, they dragged when we were cleaning Highbridge Park. People were like, oh, Bette, you need to go over and look at this, and so we went across the street and looked, and really, it was a big dump that we cleaned up, and now it's a children's garden. It's really quite gorgeous. I don't know if you know the book, The Manhattan Project.
I've certainly heard of it, and I've seen it. I've never really looked through it, though.
He points out that if you want to see what the island looked at 600 years ago, this is one of the best places to see what it actually looked like. And it's gorgeous. I cannot tell you enough. There's things that go on all year long. Up there, we have programming that happens there, and the Swindler's Cove name actually came from a guy that that helped clean it up, Billy Swindler, and he died. And he actually died. He died before it was completely reached its sort of ideal capacity. So it was named in his honor.
Very nice. And can people rent boats there now, or has that part of the program hasn't started yet?
Well,
I happen to love to row. I love being out on the water, and I'm always looking for places to go. And I tried kayaking, and frankly, kayaking in a little sort of roped off area on the side of the. The Hudson was not my idea of a good time. So I'm looking for a place where I can actually row around and maybe see some wildlife. And, you know, it sounds like maybe that's it.
Yeah, you can. Well, actually, Rode New York will be working with us this summer, and we are going to have basically Saturday Row Days up there. So it'll start probably around June and then go all summer long into the fall.
That sounds great. And people can go to your website to get more information about that, and that's the
NYRP.org. Yes.
And Drew, another thing that struck me about your website was your sort of training people for quote unquote green collar jobs.
Yeah.
Let's talk a little bit about that program, because I thought that was a really interesting initiative that you guys are working on.
Yeah, we were having a really hard time filling basically really good paying jobs in the urban forestry component, and also in our horticulture garden management.
You were having
area.
Trouble filling those jobs?
Filling those jobs. And we're talking ranges from anywhere between, you know, basically $35,000 to $60,000 jobs with full benefits.
Oh, my God.
In this particular,
sign me up, man.
But it's one of those things that, you know, people really, really sort of forget, you know, that, you know, the city is actually built in an ecosystem and in an urban forest, and we need people to help us maintain that. So the idea came that we needed to actually have more job training in New York City for these specific fields. And with the mayor's office, the Parks Department, and ourselves went together and created the Million Trees Training Program. There's three tracks. We take in 30 people between 18 and 24 years old every year, and they choose a track. And then this last year, the Obama administration, through the USDA and the Forest Service, gave $2 million to us to hire the first class on full-time.
Fantastic.
So they right now, you know, you have an amazing, you have all these people that have been trained for these jobs, actually doing this work at our organization, the Parks Department, New York Botanic Garden, Queens Botanic Garden, Brooklyn Botanic Garden, and a couple of others. So.
And where are you recruiting your people from? Are those from, like, low-income areas, so that there's, like, a job training for areas that traditionally are kind of, shall we say, underserved in the job market?
Yeah, we are focusing on those areas, but it's actually open to all city residents.
Uh-huh.
As well, and we just recruited for this year's class, and have grid. So we'll be opening up next year summer for the third class.
Mm-hmm.
And you can always get that information on our website. And if you want to, you can sign up on our website to get alerts for things like that as well. And if anyone's interested, they should definitely go to nyrp.org and sign up for if they have an interest in the third class of Green Collar Job Million Trees Training Program.
Cool. And what about internships for people who are not yet old enough to actually have a job, like, say, the 14 or 13 to 16-year-old bracket? Do you guys have, like, summer training, summer intern programs for kids like that?
We do. We
have,
we do, and again, the best way to go is to the website to get that information,
mm-hmm.
and we will be, we usually start opening up our interned programs in April for filling, and we usually have some in our education division, in our horticulture division, and then also in our Million Trees division.
Uh-huh. Drew, let me ask you another question. I've lost my train of thought. Oops, sorry. But in terms of these job training programs, like, do you see, I know that you said on your website that you're hoping to become a model for other urban organizations like this.
Mm-hmm.
And how do you see that? Are you sending out organizers from NYRP, mm-hmm. are you sending people out to talk to other urban centers about what you guys are doing and how to sort of replicate that, how does that work? How can you become a model for other people?
Yeah, we will be. One of the great things is, you know, we've really focused on this Million Trees training program, and we split it into tracks. So people, mm-hmm. it's not just one big sort of fell swoop of this. People could pick what they were interested in, such as arboriculture, or they could pick garden management and horticulture, or they could pick more design and construction.
Right.
And so there were specific tracks. And then after that, after they graduated, you know, from there, that's what we would focus on. And we graduated out of 30 people. We graduated 26 this last May. So
wow.
A lot of people did not, you know, decided that we would probably come in between 6 and 10 people graduating. So we
right.
really exceeded those expectations.
Exceeded that, yeah.
And it's really the one-on-one help and assistance that we give these kids. I mean, you have to understand that a lot of these kids come from families, you know, that their father or their mother or their grandmother or whomever has not basically had a full-time job ever.
Right.
So it's like a complete sort of different idea of what you have to deal with. So we have mentors,
wow.
And we have this whole. It's just an amazing program, and we're very proud of it. After this class, we actually were just down in Washington D.C. on Friday, letting the Forest Service know how this training's going, and we will be getting together a group of other larger cities to go through some of our findings and how we're doing this and making basically, you know, New York City, you know, a model, believe it or not, of green collar job training, which is pretty cool.
But it should be a model. I mean, I think that I can't speak for other cities, but it does seem to me that over the last few years, especially the number of people who are involved in urban gardening, community gardens, raising food in, you know, unconventional ways, has just grown exponentially. One of the guests that I've had on here was the Gotham Greens gardener.
Yeah.
And she was just a tremendous guest. Jennifer, I think, I forgot her last name, but she was fabulous. And one of the people that we had hoped to have on and unfortunately didn't work out was Dixon Dave Pommier, who is mm-hmm. the Vertical Farming Project.
Yep.
And so do you see your organization ever moving into more sort of, shall we say, capitalist-based model of gardening, or is it going to stay sort of that earthy, crunchy community garden thing where, you know, if you spend your time working in the garden, you're going to, you know, reap the benefits, but otherwise it's not really open to the rest of the group?
No, I think, you know, we're actually playing around with an idea at the moment, and we've got about an acre of property over in Bathgate in the Bronx.
Uh-huh.
And we actually also own a restaurant called the New Leaf Restaurant and Bar in Fort Tryon Park.
Yeah, absolutely. I've been
and
there.
We are going to actually create an urban farm that will actually feed. And our goal is that we will grow all of the produce and hopefully eggs and everything else that we need in that particular property in the Bronx for the restaurant.
Fantastic. Well, I see urban farming as a growing initiative, and I think that New York is really well poised to be in the forefront of that. So it's kind of an exciting... I mean, right here at Roberta's Restaurant, we have, on top of the shipping containers from which I am broadcasting right now, we have a jerry-rigged greenhouse with a lot of produce growing, as well as several other sort of empty lots where they're growing produce that feed this restaurant. So
I'm going to have to come out and see that. That
sounds
pretty cool.
Really, next time, Drew, I hope you'll come back for regular updates. Like when you guys get your rowing program going, come back and come into the studio and we'll give you some of the fabulous Roberta's food. But you can also check out the greenhouse thing, because it's one of the things that is interesting about this particular project, and which I think is true of many of these urban farming projects, is that it doesn't take a lot of money to get it started.
No, it doesn't.
It really doesn't. And it can be done almost anywhere. And if people are just willing to put in the sweat, you can actually grow a lot of produce in these very small containers. It's amazing how much you can put in there.
It is.
And so like when you guys have an acre, it doesn't maybe sound like a lot to somebody who grew up on a farm or something like that. But an acre of produce where it's planted in containers and it's really, you know, sort of well manicured and put together, you can grow enough for quite a few people to feed a family on.
You can. And on an acre, we're hoping to... You know, we want to get a round table together on an acre of property. We want to grow enough that we're going to be able to feed our restaurant. It does about 50,000 people a year.
Wow.
And so that's we're trying to figure out how we can make this happen. I think it could be an amazing model for other cities out there if we can figure, you know, how to make this happen.
Well, I think that initiatives like the Gotham Greens or Dixon Dave Pommier's, you know, vertical farming project, these are two ways that show creative and innovative plans for mm-hmm. growing a huge amount of food without using a lot of energy,
right,
a lot of water, or a lot of dirt. And I think that people don't recognize that, like, our conventional farming methods are actually really very wasteful, aside from the fact that they tend to pollute a lot of groundwater.
Actually, farming is one of the biggest polluters in the country.
Absolutely.
So, believe it or not. And people really, when you say that, they're sort of like, what are you
talking about? Oh, my God. Oh, well, I mean, I keep up. I'm particularly interested in the meat business, and I keep up with a couple of meat blogs. I mean, the idea that farming is somehow responsible for some of global warming, I mean, the screams and protests of, like, how don't these people understand what it takes to feed the country? And, well, you know, actually most people don't. But I think that even farmers can have something to learn. I mean, Joel Zalatin and his farm in Virginia, that's a model that I can imagine being adopted by many more people. But, you know, it doesn't really speak to the industrialized nature of agriculture the way that hydroponics or Dixon de Pommier's ideas of vertical farming do. And, you know, I'd like to see more, especially in urban centers and organizations like yours. I'd love to see the kind of innovation that's like, let's do this. Let's raise the money. Let's make it happen. And let's go forward with stuff that's really going to make an impact in coming years.
I agree. And I think one of the most important things that we need to do, especially with the younger folks, is get back to the whole idea that everyone understands where the food comes from.
Yes.
You know, that is just complete, or even what season food is in.
Absolutely.
Like, no one has a clue on, I remember growing up, my grandmother would be like, okay, well, we're having strawberry pie. Well, you can't have that right now.
Yeah, because it's like, December.
Yeah, it's like...
this is when we have pumpkin.
Exactly. There's like certain things you eat at certain times, and, you know, what's in... I mean, if you go out on the street and ask people, what's the season for this or that, or asparagus or whatever, I guarantee you, majority of the people would just look at you like, I have no idea what you're talking about.
Yeah.
Because they think it's available all the time, whenever they want it, and the whole sort of seasonality concept is gone. It's sort of frivolous. It's like a magazine thing now. Oh, it's time for, you know, pumpkin pie, because that's what they're saying everywhere.
Yes.
I can get anything anytime.
Well, in a way, though, I mean, I think that it would be very hard to sell the American nation on a program other than that. But I think what people need to realize is that if you can't guarantee to a farmer that they're going to be able to sell that crop, then they have no incentive to build the infrastructure, say, a hydroponic garden or a greenhouse in which they're going to grow strawberries in January.
Yeah.
And it's really a question of supporting the farm in a way that is meaningful to them by saying, yes, I'm absolutely going to buy this product from you.
Yeah.
And therefore, you can feel safe in taking out a bank loan and borrowing the money to grow yourself a greenhouse.
Yeah.
I mean, and without that commitment to family farms or to even, you know, mid-size or large farms, you know, it can't just all be out in California and in Chile. I mean, people need to understand that it's not easy to be a farmer. It's a lot of hard work, and there's a lot of things that can go wrong. And the more we are able to build things like a vertical farm tower or greenhouse farming or hydroponics, the more we can control that and control our environment.
Yeah.
But that takes money.
I think a lot of gardeners in New York City this year, especially over on the East Coast, found that, you know, things can go really wrong. This is probably one of the worst years for all vegetables across the board.
Oh yeah, no question about it. I mean, we had somebody on from Cornell talking about the tomato blight.
Oh yeah.
I mean, you know, people don't really what an impact that had on local, especially local farmers.
Yeah.
That was huge. So I think we're going to have to wrap this up in a minute, Ju. But tell me what, you know, going forward, what else are you guys focusing on? Like, what else do you hope to accomplish in the next, you know, 6 to 12 months with the New York Restoration Project?
Well, again, one thing is continue green the city, planting trees, and then really, really focusing on, you know, on our urban farm, great food concepts that we're bringing to all of our community gardens all over the place with education for everyone. That's a big push.
I'm going to interrupt you for a second and say, do you offer cooking classes in addition to the idea of urban farming and using a lot of fresh produce?
We do. We actually have, in our Target garden in the Bronx, actually just built a kitchen in that particular garden. It's spectacular.
Because one of the things I've noticed is, like, you know, and I'm not original in saying this, I heard Dan Barber say it 6 months ago at a seminar I went to, but It was like, you know, we can talk about locavore and local foods and, you know, sustainable, blah, blah, blah. But if people aren't cooking, this is not relevant. I mean, it has to be absolutely part of a curriculum that includes teaching people how to use these products.
Yeah. And we definitely have that. We actually hired someone on our education staff from Alice Waters, California.
Fantastic.
Operation, who's putting together, is basically going to do what they did out there. We're going to do it here in our gardens and in other areas for us. So
that sounds amazing. Well, the website to go to is nyrp.org.
You got it.
Right, New York Restoration
Everything's
Project.
Up there, and register online too, and you can get updates for us from us on all of our programs and when we're recruiting for certain things. And as you said when you started off, and I appreciate that, it is a great website. We just spent a lot of time making it more interactive.
Mm-hmm. I know. It was brilliant. I recommend it to everybody. There's a lot of information there. There's some incredibly cool things going on. You guys have amazing goals. I was so impressed. And, you know, thanks to Bette Midler for starting this organization, and thanks to you for keeping it running. And, you know, I wish you all the best of luck with the next 6 months or so.
Thank you.
And Drew, please do stay in touch with me. Let's have you back, you know, come to the restaurant, check out what we're doing here, and, you know, let's have you on to talk about all the summer programs you guys are going to be launching around about April.
That would be great, and we'd love to tour you around some of our sites as well.
I would
so
love to come.
Firsthand.
Thank you very much. I'd love to do that.
Okay.
Thanks, Drew. Take care. Bye-bye. Ooh, I hear the fade. This is The Main Course. It's part Q. That's our second hour of programming where we talk about other things besides food. This is your host, Katie Kiefer. My counterpart, Patrick Martins, is still in Kansas City, still counting turkeys. We are sponsored today by The Hearst Ranch. My engineer is Nat Wiener. My producer is Jack Inslee. And my guest right now is Rosemarie Morse, with whom I worked for about 10 years, or not quite. We did book promotion together, book publicity. And as soon as his cab finds this location, Roberta's Pizza at 261 Moore Street in Bushwick, we will be talking with Henry Zook of Book Court in Brooklyn, one of the most prestigious independent booksellers left in New York City. And we'll be talking about the independent booksellers' role in reading, writing, and promotion as soon as Henry and his cab find Roberta's. But in the meantime, Rosie and I are going to talk about what it was like to promote books 10 years ago and what it's like to promote books now. And as you may have heard in the first segment with Joanna Pruess and Bob Lape, it ain't gotten any easier. And it has sure gotten a lot more different than it used to be.
Yes, very, very different. What is so interesting now, or as opposed to 10 years ago, we didn't talk about platform 10 years ago.
No.
About books. We talked about the book, qua book. Now, without a platform, you don't have a shot at promoting a book. And what is a platform? Platform is everything that you can talk about the book that is not the book.
Yeah, right. What niche does it fit into?
That's
How
right.
do you market it? What are the credentials of the author?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, anything but what the book is actually
is
about.
Is she pretty? Can we put her on television?
Oh, yeah.
Or does she simply have a radio face? And can she talk on radio?
Yeah.
I mean, it's another thing. And
that's, or talk on camera.
And talk on camera. And nowadays, you know, you have lots and lots of media coaches that have to get the repeat phrases that people come up. You know what I mean? All that stuff that has to be removed from the way you speak.
But you also have to have your messaging together, right, Rosie?
Absolutely. Your messaging together. And then what you have to really learn, that no matter who your interviewer is, you decide what you're going to talk about. So if they ask you about what the weather in California is, you really start saying, oh, and then in my book, engine power, we talk about how the climate change, you see. So in other words, what you really have to do is stay on message regardless of what curveball is thrown at you.
Well, Sarah Palin was really the perfect exponent of that staying on message, because when she was doing those debates, remember, I was so amazed by the way they could ask her any question and she would just turn it into something else. Oh, I have a caller online.
Mm-hmm.
We have a caller. Oh. How exciting. Is this a would-be author or is this a published author? Hello?
Kind of more the first one, unfortunately. This is Patrick. Hi, Katie. Hi,
Rosemarie. Patrick. Hi, darling. How are you?
Good,
how's,
thanks.
How's the turkey count going?
Turkeys are fine. I'm driving to the Bass Pro Shop with Mary, but we've been listening to the show. And
amazing.
I've enjoyed it. And I wanted to know if I could ask a question. Katie, do you have a moment for one?
Yeah, I think we have a moment.
I wanted to ask what it takes for, like, a young writer with, like, a good idea, like, what it takes to get something published, like, to get a good idea off the ground, and, like, what a young writer would have to do to get a book published.
Well, I think one of the first things that the writer has to do is speak to an agent or try to acquire an agent, and in speaking to the agent will have to sort of think whether this idea is saleable. After that, the author has to write a proposal. Sometimes authors know how to do a proposal. Sometimes they need to have someone to come up with the proposal for them. The proposal is the most important thing in the process, because most books, nonfiction books, are sold at the proposal stage with perhaps a sample chapter, but you have to have, you know, an outline of the book.
And be aware, Patrick, and listeners, that Rosemary works for one of the foremost literary agencies in New York City, the Inkwell Agency, and is privy to people's proposals, has really looked at what it takes to get one of the Inkwell people interested in trying to sell their book. So just with that caveat in mind, Rosie, go ahead and say what's next. After you've written your proposal, what happens next?
Well, after you've written your proposal, if it's something that an agent thinks it's quite hot, and it is submitted to a bunch of publishers, and then one hopes that because the idea is so good, et cetera, and because the agent is so good at selling it, is that you have a bidding war, so that in fact you can get, you know, more money than you would get if the book was sent to people individually, one by one by one. And often what the agent will do is put a deadline, let's say next Thursday I want all bids in. But that will happen for a book that really, you know, is commercial.
But what if you have a book that is just, you know, just kind of your garden variety novel or something like that, and, you know, you want to make it happen, but it's just not that easy. I mean, how do you get an agent interested in a novel? For instance, you and I certainly promoted enough novels to realize how hard that was. and there were some novels that we were willing to pick up because we saw them as commercially viable. Mm-hmm. And then there were many other novels that were that we just passed up, not because they weren't good or well written, but because we just didn't see them as a commercial entity. Henry Zook.
Yeah.
Henry Zook from Book Court has joined us.
And he can tell.
Henry can tell us
really
the bookseller side of this.
What is commercially viable. But what is interesting now in the publishing house is, for instance, there are a lot of novels that have vampires, angels.
Oh my God! All of the crazy extraterrestrial or fantasy. This fantasy element. Henry, put your headphones on so you can hear well.
And had one of these people that has sold millions of copies come to us when we had the public relations agency, I would have sent them packing.
Absolutely.
Because I thought this is not.
I would have said to you, forget
all.
It, Rosie. I don't like that kind of book. I'm not promoting it.
That's right.
You know, because the fact is that you have to be pretty smart about who you're sending your proposal to, even mm-hmm. to recognize, how am I going to know whether or not this agent or this agency is going to be interested in my type of book, whether it's fiction or nonfiction? And how do people figure that out? Do they look at other books and find out who the agent was for that? You go to Barnes & Noble,
correct.
You look at books that are kind of like yours, and
yes,
then
you do,
call the publisher, find out who the agent was who sold that book. And
well, unless the agent was really a dog, generally, when you open a book, there's an acknowledgement page, and the acknowledgement page, one of the people that is always acknowledged is the agent, and that's how you
right.
figure out who that is.
Yeah, but that's an important page to read, is the acknowledgement page.
So.
I don't think people realize just how much information you can glean out of your acknowledgements page. Let me take this moment to welcome our guest, Henry Zook from Brooklyn Book Court. I'm sorry it was hard for you to find
Thank
the
you.
Studio.
Thank you. Sorry.
Thank you so much for joining us. And Henry, meet Rosemary Morse.
Hi, Rosemary.
Rosemary is the publicity consultant for Inkwell Agencies and my former boss. She and I worked together for about 8 years doing publicity for books.
Great.
So we know your industry really
okay.
well.
All right.
So you have not fallen into...
Maybe better than I know it.
I doubt it. Yeah. You've been doing this for quite a while. Book Court's been in business for what? About
25 years.
I was going to say 25, 30
yeah.
years. Yeah.
Yeah.
And so Book Court, the reason I asked you in today, actually, Henry, was because the Independent Booksellers Associate, is it the Independent?
IBNYC,
yeah,
Independent Booksellers in New York
of
City.
New York City, is launching, or launched, I should say, on November 15th, about 10 days of, or not quite 10 days
a
of
week,
programming,
yeah.
a week of programming in which you guys are bringing authors in and hosting events all around the city. These can all be located on your website, which is
IBNYC.com.
And there's a schedule of events there, and it shows which independent booksellers are involved. I didn't really see what the events were so much. It could be because I just didn't scroll to the right tab, but
It may have been that, you know, not all the stores got the events linked
up
in,
on the,
but
yeah.
But I know we've got, you know, at Book Court we've got a number of events going on.
So who do you guys have at your shop?
Well, I can't tell you exactly. Our website can tell you exactly. I know we had because I don't do
the,
yeah, I know. I don't do the events. My son Zach does, and he scheduled an event for a juvenile author this morning. It was a very successful event. A juvenile author who's written two books about girls being catty, and then there was another event a little bit later for teenage girls.
Uh huh. Geez, I'm sorry, I don't
being
live
catty.
In Brooklyn. Yeah,
no.
Right. Being
well,
catty.
Yeah.
And is everybody going to bring their catty teenage girls? I got one, by the
yeah.
way. I have
well,
a catty teenage
good for
girl,
you.
So you know, I know what we're talking about.
I missed out
about.
On that. Yeah.
Good. I had two 13-year-old girls spending the night last
yeah.
night catting about a third one. So,
well, good.
I got good. That whole story completely down. But we were just before you came in, Rosemary, because she works for Inkwell,
uh-huh.
was talking about what it takes to market a book to an agent, and maybe you can help us talk about a little bit about why independent booksellers are important to especially new authors. And what you guys can do that is different from big box stores
sure.
In selling books.
Sure. Well, you know, one of the things about independents is they're approachable. It's as an individual author, you can't really get into the chains unless they've decided to buy you. And that's very corporate and it's, you know, pretty much based in New York City and you just can't get through to those people. You know, we have authors all the time that come in and, show us their books that have recently been published and, you know, ask that we carry it if we're not already carrying it. And frequently we get people with people that want us to take their books on consignment.
Really?
Books they've self-published.
Yeah. How about you? Oh, really? So self-published authors, this is an outlet for them?
Sure.
Is to
yeah.
actually sell through to an independent bookseller?
Yeah, yeah, and they can walk in
and
ask for someone to speak to, you know,
uh-huh.
a buyer or, you know, a manager or something. And you know, we're pretty open to that, especially for Brooklyn authors.
Sure.
You know, taking stuff on consignment.
I think that's probably true in any city. For an independent bookseller
yeah.
to remain relevant to the community, they want to be able to support community authors. So that
exactly.
makes a lot of sense.
But, you know, getting into the chains is a whole other matter. It's really, you know, it's very corporate and it's...
Well, Rosie, I know that when you and I were booking authors into book tours,
mm-hmm.
One of the first calls we would place was to Miwa Messer at Barnes & Noble,
mm-hmm.
who was the national coordinator of events in Barnes & Noble. So we would say, well, we have a book, an author who's going to, you know, Detroit, Ann Arbor, Chicago, you know, Cleveland, et cetera, and she would book us into those stores. But with independent events, how do you guys, you know, I mean, we had a list of independent bookstores that we worked
Absolutely.
With a lot, like Changing Hands or
sure.
or Rainy Day Books or something in Kansas City. But, you know, it was... it seemed like it was a very different sort of animal somehow, working
oh, yes.
with the independents.
Well, I find it much, much better working with the independents because, first of all, you know, you got the events person, and often you could also speak to the owner.
Yeah.
And once they decided to take the book on, they would help you do the promotion. They would give you a list of local radio, local television, and so on and so forth. They would actually help you. You know, get promotion for the book, and that makes, I think, all the difference.
Do you guys do that at Brooklyn Book Court?
Yeah, we do. We definitely
yeah.
do. You know, we're very accessible.
So we would contact Zach Zook.
That's mm-hmm. correct. Yeah, Zach at
bookcourt.org. Zach
no,
Zook.
No, it's very suitable.
Very suitable.
Very suitable.
I did contact Zach Zook for an author for whom I was doing the publicity for a while, Ingrid Abramovich, who's an author from Brooklyn,
uh-huh.
and he has a book on, townhouses, row houses, brownstones, etc. And I booked the event by calling
Zach Zook, and he was all ears because it was a Brooklyn author.
Yeah, Zach's great with the authors, mm-hmm. and you know he's really good at what he does. And I've got to say, he's put on a great series of events, you know, since he started it seriously this spring.
Do you guys have a very active website where you have a lot of people hooked into it that are looking, you know, that are looking at what you're doing? And
well, I assume so. I mean, you know, Zach does a mailing once a week, an updated bestseller list. We have our own internally generated bestseller list of 50 titles every week. They're all discounted 20%, and he shoots that out when it's revised every Monday, as long as a revised list of what the upcoming events are. And I know there are well over 1,000 names on that list right now, maybe even 2,000.
Right. And what about one of the things that's been intriguing me, because I read Shelf Awareness every day.
Sure.
Is the price wars between the big box stores, Amazon and Barnes & Noble Online and Costco, Trader Joe's, not Trader Joe's, Costco, and I guess Sam's Club is the other big one.
Yeah.
And the fact that publishers are, shall we say, they will knuckle under to these big box deals in a way that I find, I don't understand how it serves their cause to sell a new book like the new, say, the new Harry Potter book, which retailed at $28 or something and then was being sold by Costco for maybe 10 or 9 or 8.
Yeah,
I mean,
like
something
that.
Incredible, like not even barely the cost of the printing and the cover. I mean, like,
well,
why aren't they more engaged in helping guys like you stay competitive?
Yeah, well, the thing is that, you know, legally, I mean, Costco and Sam's Club, they all have a right to sell their books at whatever price they
choose. So they will buy them at the same price as you
discount them? I'm sure they're getting a couple more points on the discount, but, you know, they're treating them as loss leaders, you know, to get people in. And apparently 40% of all the books in the country go through those
oh, my God, when
clubs.
Penny Iannucci says, you know, gives the blessing, it's like, whoa.
Yeah.
You have just made a big sale.
So, you know, I really think they're taking a loss on them as Amazon is on the ebooks and stuff like that. And publishers tell me repeatedly that they're selling, you know, books at essentially the same discount schedule. They're selling them to all
to independents.
Yeah.
Except that independents are paying more rent typically, or at least don't have
in many cases, yes.
Yeah. Right. Yeah. And they don't have the product mix that brings in
well,
you know, a bigger audience.
You mean like Weber grills?
Yeah, exactly.
And, yeah.
Furniture,
yeah,
you know, computers, iPods.
Yeah,
I mean, even if you are selling,
we haven't gone there. We've gone to coffee and things like that, but we haven't gotten much further at this point. But you know, it's a business, and it's very much you know, all those things contribute to it. You know?
Well, one of the articles that I read about you, Henry, was an interview that you did with Publishers Weekly,
okay.
And he's scratching his head over that one.
Yeah,
like,
yeah.
What did I say? But what you said was the fact that you were smart enough. Well, you didn't say yourself that you were smart enough, but Publishers Weekly said you were smart enough to have bought your location at a time when you're in Cobble Hill, right?
Yes, that's correct.
At a time when Cobble Hill was not as expensive as it is now. And of course, you know, retail space, you know, rents for sort of competitive to Manhattan prices at this point in Cobble Hill. So so that's what's enabled you to stay in business, and you were able to acquire a space next door and really expand and, you know, turn into something that's been a real community icon, actually, over the last 10, 15 years. And so, but what about bookstores that didn't have that opportunity? Like, how are they managing? I mean, I know that there was another woman who was part of this thing that I wanted to have on the show a couple of weeks ago who wasn't able to come, Janet Green or something. She's a Greenpoint Books. What just opened up in Brooklyn?
Oh, Word Bookstore? No, Greenlight.
Yeah, Greenlight.
And,
Jennifer.
Green.
Jennifer O'Flynn.
Jennifer. No, Jessica.
Jessica.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, Jessica.
Yeah. And I was just curious, like, how, I know you can't speak for her, but like, what are the odds? I mean, what's facing her in terms of the challenges that the independent bookseller faces overall?
Well, what's facing her is what's facing all of us. I mean, you know, in my situation, my rent doesn't go up over time. Hers does, as well as everyone else who rents. That's the downside to renting and the upside to buying. Not that there aren't hidden costs in owning, but she's got that to deal with. You know, usually in New York, it's leases coming due and rents. And if anyone's leases come due in the last 5 years, I'm sure, you know, they've had serious impediments to renewing it.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah.
And what else, what do independent bookstores do that's different from big box stores in terms of promoting their authors? Like, how do you stay connected to your community in a way that Barnes & Noble doesn't? Because, of course, you all have the author events. And we all want, I mean, as a publicist, I was always very anxious to book somebody into my 82nd Street and Broadway, you know, location of Barnes & Noble, because that was like a really big deal there. Yeah. And how do you guys compete with that?
Well, we're just a lot more connected. I mean, you know, first of all, we have sort of a screening process for authors we haven't gotten in yet. I mean, some authors, like we had E.L. Doctorow and Tracy Kidder, you know, those automatically will bring someone in.
Is that your phone ringing, Henry?
I don't believe so.
Because you might have to turn it off. How about you, Rosemary? Do you have your phone on?
Off.
Rosemary's phone is off, boys. Don't point the finger at her. Mine's off, too.
Mine should be on silent, but...
It doesn't matter. We hear it's the antenna.
I'm sorry.
We just learned that in our last interview. It's never happened before, actually, strangely enough. But anyway. Okay, thank you, Henry.
Where were we?
We were talking about what you offer is, like, how do you guys compete with the big box stores in terms of your events?
Well, keep in mind, I mean, you know, it is an event. We like to have events because they take up a fair amount of space in the store for a couple hours that bring us a return.
Uh-huh.
So we like to kind of flesh out what kind of audience, you know, where the author's from, blah, 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 and what kind of, you know, kind of audience they think they can bring in with them and that kind of thing.
You bring up the most interesting point here, because here is something that I really wanted to talk to both of you about, and that is what, you know, authors, I think, feel like when they're finished writing the book and they've sold it. I know it's not you. when they finish writing the book and they've sold it, that's the end of their job, and that promotion belongs to the publicist, whether it's in-house or out-of-house or the bookstore or whatever. And the fact is that, as Joanna Pruess was saying earlier in the first hour of the show, that she and her husband have taken a really active role in promoting their events and creating events which would not normally have been done by her publisher. And so what made me think of this was something that I saw, I think, on Shelf Awareness also, about how authors really need to take more of a leading role in that. And I wondered if you could both speak to that in terms of, like, what can authors be doing that would help themselves as well as helping the outlets that are selling their book, especially independent booksellers.
Well, but for instance, let's say someone like Ingrid Abramovich, again, who's who you had on, I think you already had her in the bookstore, but I'm not sure anymore. But the point is, she's on Facebook and Twitter, so all her, you know, and she has, because she lives in Brooklyn, she has obviously a lot of friends in Brooklyn. So what she does, she will announce not only on her website, but she will also, you know, Twitter and on Facebook tell people, well, next Tuesday I am going to be at Book Court. And I think now bookstores really rely on that, and also rely on your list sometimes. You know, people provide postcards, but mostly sort of by email. And I think that that's a very important way for booksellers to actually choose authors. Because if you don't have any audience, it's very hard for them to draw them in. And what happens is you're using important real estate. So, for, you know, for the bookstore for 2-3 hours, that section cannot be used, and so you're losing sales.
Right.
Yeah. And you know, there are a lot of ways. I mean, the internet has just been fabulous in so many ways. Of course, some people think, you know, it's killed independent bookstores, but in other ways, it's such a great free marketing tool for authors, for bookstores.
Yeah.
Mass email, you know, emails go out, and it's a great, and so the author, I'm finding now, as opposed to 25 years ago, has to do a lot more legwork themselves. And, you know, it's very usual to hear them say about, you know, the publisher didn't do anything for my book. And,
yeah, and it's like tough shit.
Yeah, well, you know, publishers have formulas
for
advertising, promotion, that kind of thing. And
but a lot of times they don't even want to invest. I mean, certainly Rosemary and I saw that when we worked together for years promoting books, was that, you know, if the book is sort of low on the totem pole in the catalog, like the placement's in the back of the catalog, and it's kind of a small book, or it's an author that's not very well known.
It's got half a page.
It's got a half a page, yeah, right. And maybe the picture's in black and white. You know, they aren't going to get any juice out of the publisher. And I think that it's really important for anybody who's going into, you know, who wants to be a writer and wants to get their work published. I think it's really important to recognize that you can't, it's the days of Maxwell Perkins are over.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
I mean, even the days of Rosemary Morris, when you would, as an editor, would get on the phone and promote the hell out of your books.
Sure. Oh, very much so. They don't do that.
Not happening.
They don't do that. I think, you know, we have, at Inkwell, we represent a romance, historical romance writer, Robin Maxwell. And she was, you know, she was complaining a lot about the fact that the publisher wasn't going to do anything, et cetera, et cetera. So I said to Robin, hey, this is your baby. The romance people are all online. So why don't you start going to everybody's website, everybody romance writer's website, start contributing there. You start telling them how wonderful those books are, and eventually they're going to pay you back. And guess what? The woman did such an incredible homework that, you know, she sold more than about 900 books off her website.
Wow.
And I just, and afterwards she said, well, I did it all myself. And I said, Robin, it's your book. You have to do it all yourself.
That's right.
And by the way, she listened to me. Other people are too proud. Oh, God, I'm not going to do it. Well, you're not going to sell.
It's not even so much pride as I think a lot of people have a really deep-seated aversion to selling themselves, whether it's selling their book or selling their personality or whatever. It's very uncomfortable, and I understand that. And I think that when that's the case, if you're that kind of person, then it's probably worth your while to invest in somebody who will create a website for you or even monitor it for you, and all you have to do is sort of like write a little blog every day or something. But it's I guess my point in going there is that it can't just be on the rest on the shoulders of the bookstore, however much you hand sell a book, right, Henry? I mean, that's one of the great advantages to being connected with an independent bookseller or with a group like Independent Booksellers of New York, is that you have people who are really smart, they're knowledgeable, they love books, and they will hand sell a book. And I remember doing, when we did a book for Stephen Horn, and you were on the phone with every mystery bookseller in the United States.
Yes, I did.
Saying, you know, check out this book. Order the book. It's a great mystery. It's a great thriller. You're going to love it. It's fabulous. And by God, the guy sold a boatload of books.
Yeah,
and
did.
His
well,
events
he sort of
did
became,
really well.
You know, the paperback came on bestseller list.
Yeah, exactly. And
but
it really
takes that kind of.
And I think authors can't rely on publishing houses or publicists even at this point to do that unless you want to pay you a lot of money.
And of
well,
course,
or if you have people like us who are already dedicated.
Yeah.
You know,
but even now.
Radio is another, you know, wonderful tool to get your book out there.
But have you noticed that there's like, there is one book radio show in Manhattan. One. Leonard Lopate.
Leonard Lopate, yeah.
And this, and right now, me.
Yeah.
I'm going to give Lenny a run for his money.
Go for it.
No,
I mean,
but
yeah.
Also,
and there's Janet Coleman at WBAI.
Yeah, that's right.
And that's it.
Well, but, you know, they have tremendous power, as does the New York Times Book Review. You know, I will be really upset when that book review disappears, if it does. You know, it's really the Bible kind of the business, you know.
Interesting.
So, but, you know, getting, you know, and of course there's Oprah and all those things, but, you know, for the average author, getting that kind of attention is you know, very
it's the holy
very,
grail. It's pretty hard.
Yeah.
It's really hard to get out there.
It's tough. It's really tough.
But you do have other NPR shows. I mean, maybe it's not for fiction, but for the you know,
for nonfiction, if you fit into
non-fiction.
A news category, you know, if you're a topical and contemporary, you know, issue, if it's politics related or war related or military related or something like that, yeah, sure, you can find outlets for that. But you know, for the straight up, you know, just the. You know, somebody who's maybe a little off topic in terms of contemporary news or somebody who's written a wonderful fiction piece, there are very few shows that take those books on. I mean, we knew that when we were booking fiction authors. I mean, at a certain point, Rosemary and I decided, forget it, we're not doing fiction anymore as publicity. Because we could not find enough venues for them. There were so many of them disappeared, and then so many of the newspapers either downsized or closed their book sections, there was no place to go with fiction.
And that's funny because we find it's the best-selling genre in the store by far.
Do you really?
By far.
So who are the authors that you like right now?
That I like? Well, Wolf Hall, Hilary Mantel, won the Booker Prize. Her book looks spectacular. I've started it. It looks just great. You know, some favorites at the moment of mine are Henning Mankell, mystery writer, Swedish mystery writer. I mean, there's a lot of great stuff out there right now. There really is. In all subject matters.
Is the
problem. You know, the great cookbooks, the great music books, this great biography of Thelonious Monk. There's just, you know, great kids' books. There's a lot of stuff.
Yeah.
A lot of really good stuff right now.
Absolutely.
Well, speaking of public relations and fiction, last summer I took on a book because I loved it. It was one of the agency's book, and it was a fellow called Frank Heiler, and he's the author of Right of Thirst, which was published by Harper in paper. So the decision to do a novel in paper already, in a sense, damages the author because the people in the press don't take it seriously. Why is it coming out in paper as opposed to in hardcover? And if I had put the same effort that I did in that book 10 years ago, I would have gotten 25 reviews.
Yeah.
As it was, I eventually did get reviewed in the New York Times, and I got actually one, the science part of the New York Times, so there were two, and the New Yorker in brief, I think was Harper's, and then the Durango paper that actually gave it one of the best reviews.
Amazing.
And some stuff online. But even to get the reviews online, it took a lot of elbow grease. In other words, you really have to know people who have those websites in order to get your book reviewed. And there was one person that is quite powerful, I still think, Nancy Pearl.
Yes.
And I cannot tell you how many times I've emailed her and so on and so forth. I didn't get anywhere, and yet it's a great book. And I think that Janet Coleman finally is going to have him on. But it was a wonderfully lyrical, important book, a serious book, not perfect. You know, nothing is perfect, but really good. But I called bookstores. I mean, I called, Mitchell Kaplan. I called all my various Richard Howarth in Oxford, Mississippi.
Sure.
It is that effort. And had I done this, you know, I did not work any less for this book than I had for Kiran Desai.
Right. Mm. Well, put in the major effort on that one, too. But that's your MO.
But that's what it takes.
And it does take that. So what authors, we should wrap it up here, but what authors should be aware of in listening to these two industry experts, or rather three, because even I can claim some expertise here, is you cannot rest on your laurels. If you think that selling your book means the end of your job, it doesn't. You need to cultivate independent booksellers of New York and around the country, actually. There are many organizations, regional organizations for independent booksellers. Those are your best friends. Mm-hmm. And you need to cultivate the online community and figure out who those people are and where your book fits in.
May I add one more thing?
Absolutely.
I went to book court for the first time, because I don't live in Brooklyn, last week or 2 weeks ago, and I spent about a couple of hours in your bookstore. And the important thing, I think, about independent bookstores is the selection of books. There
Absolutely.
Were so many books there that I thought, gee, I need to read these books. So it is, as opposed to, let's say, when you go to a big store like BNN or whatever, it's not really pre-selected. This is intelligently pre-selected, and that's why people in the community go there.
Absolutely.
Because in other words, if the New York Times become less powerful, the independent bookstores become really like a book review.
They are a book review.
Good point.
Independent booksellers are the people who are selecting the unusual books that, I mean, let's face it, the New York Times Book Review can only review so many books per issue because nobody wants to advertise in the book review section. Mm-hmm. And that's one of the things that hampers book review sections around the country, and why so many book review sections have had to close is because publishers do not support them and other businesses do not support them. Mm-hmm. And they lose, I think, a very valuable space there. But unfortunately, we have to close this interview, but Henry, I hope you'll come back. It's Henry Zook from Brooklyn
Thank
Book
you.
Court, and Rosemarie Morse
the book
from Inkwell
Thank
Agency.
You. Thank
and
you both very much.
My pleasure. I mean it. And this has been The Main Course. And thank you to my boys in the booth, Jack and Nat. And thank you to Hearst Ranch for our sponsorship. Bye-bye now.